Welcome to Climate Talk Uganda. I am Josephine Karunji. Today's episode of Climate Talk is a deep and wide-ranging conversation with Pauline Nantongo Kalunda, Executive Director of one of Uganda's most prominent environmental organizations, Ecotrust. As we'll hear, Ecotrust has developed and implemented a business model centered around environmental sustainability and improving the economic resilience of smallholder farmers in the face of climate change challenges. Pauline's a zoologist by training, though, and that's where our conversation started.
My name is Pauline Nantongo Kalunda. I work with the Environmental Conservation Trust of Uganda. I am a conservation biologist, born and bred in Uganda, educated in Uganda. I am an entomologist by training. I also have business management training. So with those two, I occupy a very special niche in the field of conservation, which is running conservation as a business. So that is the area that I specialize in.
So you're going to tell me what it's like running conservation as a business, but before that, I don't want to leave anyone behind. What's an entomologist?
An entomologist is an expert in insects. The bugs, the mosquitoes, the sassaflies, the ants. Yes, that is my area of specialism in as far as education is concerned.
So you were there and you said, I want to learn about insects.
Yes.
How did you come here to insects and bugs?
Insects are very interesting. They can be very beautiful and they can be very ugly. But also, they run the world as if I could put it that way. You know, you can't have food without the insects. They're your pollinators. Even the soils are aerated using termites. Malaria is caused by insects.
That's the one I'm familiar with.
Yeah. So most people just know the evil side of insects or the bad side of insects. But there is so much, they are so close to the base of the pyramid that everything else feeds on them. So the food cycle wouldn't be complete without the insects. They are actually very important, but they are beautiful. You see the beetles, the butterflies. Yeah, they are really interesting. When I was studying entomology, I studied it from the perspective of the ecology, of the correlations, the correlation between the insects, the animals, but also between insects and insects. Because I wanted to find out opportunities for biological control, opportunities for using other insects to control the insects that are not desirable. Especially working with wasps and ants to see if they could control the populations of sassaflies, the sassaflies that cause sleeping sickness. So when I was entering into entomology, my interest was that was that interaction. Yeah.
What brought on this interest? Were you fascinated by bugs when you were a child?
When I was growing up, I actually wanted to be a medical doctor. I think every brilliant child, their parents want them to be medical doctors. And then also, I once read a book by Benny Carson, and Gifted Hands, and What Have You, when I was in P7, and I thought, I want to be the first this man in Uganda. So yeah, so I grew up wanting to be that. But when we were going through school, they will automatically send you to the course, depending on how your grades look like. So I ended up in Faculty of Science, okay, studying zoology, psychology.
Yes, that's
and
what
botany.
I wanted you to say, psychology.
Yes.
I read somewhere that you
that I'm a psychologist as well. Yes.
So I wanted to understand psychology
and zoology.
Yes, how does that play out?
It's behavior, but human beings are animals. except we are not animals like animals. We want to feel different, or we want to be looked at differently. But, and then also the interaction, like, still comes back to the interaction between species, between species and within species. So I think I've always been more interested in that, the nexus, as opposed to specialized things. So I prefer to deal with the interactions of things.
I'm very curious about you, so I could just take this conversation to a whole level, but let me bring it back to and focus it to climate change. And now that you're telling me that you are a psychologist,
yes.
How does that play out with climate change? Do you see a relationship there?
Yes, because the majority of what causes climate change is what they call anthropogenic. Anthropogenic means people-oriented. So most of the disruptions that we have that result into climate change are caused by people's behavior. They're caused by people's behavior, but also, in order to thrive, in order to be resilient in the light of a changing climate, there is also something about behavior that is there. So my psychology has really come in very, very handy in this field of climate change. So there is something called greenhouse gases, which form a blanket that amplifies the warmth. That is why they call it global warming. So those greenhouse gases are released by activities of human beings. Every time you burn fuel by driving a car, every time you enjoy that play, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty.
No, I'm looking at you hoping there's a bit of shame even for you.
Yeah, that by the end of this conversation you'll be driven to to change a bit. Well, but of course there are certain things that we cannot do without, and that's why we also engage with other human beings. They make the changes in their lifestyles, but also they make a decision to offset their emissions. For us, we do it through tree planting. But also from that other side, for a smallholder farmer who is experiencing climate change in form of extreme prolonged droughts or too much rain or unpredictability of season changes, also they need to change behavior. Okay. They need to change behavior. They need to be able to take a step back and recognize that the world in which I'm operating has changed, and therefore there is some change they need to do in order to build their own resilience to thrive within this changing climate.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm. Tell me about your work with EcoTrust. How long have you been there, and what exactly do you do there?
I've been with EcoTrust for 18 years. I had a baby as soon as I joined, and she's now 18. So it's very easy for me to remember. Because I have an 18-year-old. Yeah, so I've been with EcoTrust for 18 years. At the end of this year, it will be 19 years. I'm almost making 20 years. So EcoTrust is such an exciting place because it's a place that has drawn from every skill, interest, orientation, talent, education that I have. So I have a profession or an opportunity to have a job that draws on every single aspect of Pauline.
Exercising your yes. entire.
Yes.
Is that what they mean when they say?
Everything of mine has grown.
Is that what they mean when they say bring your entire self to the table?
I've never heard of that, but I think yes, that is. Yes, that is. I guess that's what it is, yes. So it's really an exciting opportunity. It's been an exciting opportunity. When I was entering into my work field, I didn't think I would work in a place for more than 5 years. But I'm clocking 20, and at EcoTrust, every 5 years are different. I sat down last year to plot my life at EcoTrust. BirdLife International invited me as a former employee of theirs to share with them what institutional growth is and to tell them a story. And then I plotted my life along, and I realized that every 5 years, it's as if I'm changing jobs. even though I'm remaining in the same organization. So EcoTrust is an organization that is built around conservation finance. So conservation finance is not a simple field. So we had to come up with innovations of bringing financing into the stewards of nature, who in most cases are the smallholder farmers.
So break that down for me.
So smallholder farmers are people that feed us, the people that grow the food in Uganda, people between 1 acre and up to 10 or 15 acres. They're diversified farmers. They're not like, if you went into farming, you'd choose to say, I want to grow coffee, and you'll have a big farm of coffee. Or I want to grow trees, you'll have 10 hectares of trees, something like that. A smallholder farmer is a subsistence farmer. They have a bit, their first objective into agriculture is to feed their families. But beyond that, whatever excesses they sell. So, but 80% of the food we eat, more than 80% of the food we eat in Uganda comes from lands that are managed by those smallholder farmers. So they are a significant part of our economy. Even though the spotlight is not always on them, when they talk about mechanization, when they talk about all those things, they are having the large-scale farmer in mind, but really the person who feeds us is the smallholder farmer. And this smallholder farmer they usually say it's not sophisticated, but there's a lot of sophistication in simplicity.
A unique sophistication.
Yes, there's a lot of sophistication in simplicity. To be able to live that simple, seemingly simple life, there's a lot of sophistication that is involved. So a smallholder farmer is very innovative. A smallholder farmer experiments. So a smallholder farmer has so many innovations that don't usually come see the light of day. They are never upscaled or they never access the financing to help them to bring it to scale. But they do their innovations. So they have observed the impacts and effects of climate change. They have their own ways of using indicators of environment. They know when the ants, we call them ants, but I think they are termites. When they fly, they know the rains are about to come. They have their own ecological indicators. So they have a sophisticated system that, as an organization, we decided to occupy that niche of studying and understanding those innovations and craft them and develop them into projects that enable those innovations to achieve scale. So that is the kind of organization that I work with.
Give me an example of maybe a smallholder farmer that you've worked with under EcoTrust that has this innovation and how you've progressed that innovation.
Okay, so we have smallholder farmers that know how to use trees to safeguard the land against climate change. They know how to select trees that will be able to interact well with their crops. They know how to use trees to maintain moisture in the soil. So they know how to use trees to enable the land continue being productive even during a drought. They also know how to use trees to be able to safeguard against floods and so on and so forth. But then trees have a long gestation period.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more attractive to grow maize or beans out of it because within a season. So our innovation has been to transform the smallholder's investment horizon from just looking at the season-based beans, maize, whatever have you. So I could give you many examples, but in Kasese, we started with about 10 farmers, and those 10 farmers, so when they grow the trees, we have a system where we can quantify how much carbon dioxide has been stored on those trees, on that land as a result of those trees. They call it carbon sequestration. So you remember photosynthesis, as the trees are growing, they feed on carbon dioxide. So as the tree grows, they are actually mitigating climate change. So we sat down and said, we come up with a business model that is based on making tree growing a viable, an economically viable activity. Recognizing that the smallholder farmer uses that to build their own resilience to climate change, but while they are doing that, they are also removing carbon dioxide from the air. So we worked with companies, or we work with companies, most of them based in Europe and US, that also do a footprint. Every year they estimate how much carbon dioxide did we release into the atmosphere as a result of our activities, and then they put a dollar value to every ton of carbon dioxide. So we have a database whereby on one side we have the engagement with the companies, and on this side we have the engagement with the smallholder farmer. So the smallholder farmer is able to develop a business case where he's going to get income streams from the, both the goods and services that are coming from the tree. So it is not enough to just get the money from the company and give it to the smallholder farmer because of the carbon that they've stored on their land, because it's, the innovation is not just about money, mm-hmm. but even about, it's about triggering this investment, because the smallholder farmer has a management objective for those trees. He's growing, some of them are fruit trees, some of them are to produce timber, some of them are to produce fuel wood. So we had to use this money to enable that investment to take place. But then still it's not enough. They need access.
Every day, first of all. And I want you to first explain yes. to me what your conversation looks like with a smallholder farmer that you just told me yes. their first priority is what am I eating today?
Yes.
And now you're saying
a smallholder farmer actually has a vision. Eh? The majority of us were sent to school on the backs of smallholder farmers. So if those smallholder farmers had the vision to educate us, even today's smallholder farmers has a vision. It's just that he's been cornered, he's been squeezed in a corner by climate change, but also by all of us. We don't quite understand them. Until the national IDs came, they were not documented in any way. They don't have birth certificates, they don't have passports, they don't have IDs, you know. So they've really been marginalized, even though they feed us. But a smallholder farmer has a vision. A smallholder farmer actually has a long-term vision. When you speak with those farmers and you tell them, okay, what are the benefits you expect from trees, they will really say, as an inheritance to leave for my children. I need to have my land with assets to give to my children. My house is too ramshackled, but the trees are there. My children can inherit. So they actually have those dreams, but it's just that they cannot, because of the vagaries of weather and nature and what have you, they don't have that space to sit and plan. So if you're able to sit with them and say, okay, we have a system that we use where we call it a vision road journey. So we sit as a community and say, okay, everybody get a piece of paper, draw a picture, what is your dream? So we do a big circle and we put the dreams, the different people's dreams in there. And then we do another small circle this side and say, within the perspective of that dream, where are you? So we draw that circle. Then we cluster them into objectives. Eh? We cluster all these, those who want better housing, education, what have you. Then we draw a roadmap. How are we going to get from where we are to where we want to go? Then also, what opportunities do we have to be able to meet this? And what challenges and obstacles do we have that will prevent us? So for us as an organization, we present ourselves as one of the opportunities to remove these challenges. So that's why I'm telling you that I know that the challenge is, financing is one of the challenges, but it's not just about financing, even the timing of the financing, and the whole, so we end up building a business ecosystem around tree planting. So for these particular people who started, like there were 11 of them, they also started a circle. So the payments from the carbon offsets are paid through the circle. But so that those payments capitalize that circle. So the rest of the members of the community can also join the circle because they can borrow from these people's money. And then they get interest from that. But also, the carbon farmers can use their agreements with us as collateral to access loans. So right now, they have a SACCO that has 10 branches in that district. Each branch is also a coffee bulking business that all the communities there depend on. Now they are in the region of 30,000 farmers that are part of that system. So the innovations and ideas of the first 11 were able to be scaled out to do this. We have another group in Lubirizi Mitoma. Lubirizi Mitoma was the very first group to onboard. So even these 30 farmers learned from the 33 farmers that we started 20 years ago in Lubirizi Mitoma. Those ones, for example, they are the suppliers of some of the tea factories. They supply fuel wood to those tea factories. So yes, they grow the trees for their own, to build their own resilience. They earn from both the products and the services, but they have big businesses. As in, they have they harvest lorries and lorries, and yet the land is still under forestry. So they found a way of sustainably harvesting and replacing where they harvest. They switched those particular pieces of land from maize and beans and what have you to tree growing, because it is an economic activity. Yet, yes, it supports their own enterprises because they have other things. They have, right now we have what we call a beekeeping center of excellency. So it's a real business. So these smallholder farmers, with their innovations, completely moving away from being grantees that receive donations and what have you, to yes, they receive grants and donations, but on top of that, they also sell goods and services, and they thrive on the back of selling those goods and services.
Mm. What's your most favorite success story for a smallholder farmer, an individual that you've worked with?
Yeah, we have this lady who was actually one of the pioneer farmers who started out a widow of about 23, but was also a teacher. And she said when she lost her husband, her mother-in-law told her that that land your husband inherited from her father. She had also lost her husband when those children were still very young. But the same way as I used that land to raise your husband, you will also use that land to raise those children. Then she joined the program. Now those two children, one of them is a clinical officer, another one is a lawyer. But also she built a school through all these, using the income and then taking out loans, using that agreement you have with us as collateral and so on and so forth. She has a primary school, which is one of the best primary schools in Mitoma district, where all the other farmers send their children to. For me, that's my best story. Yes.
You, from listening to that story, you're right. We all have come to be what we are from the backs of the smallholder farmer.
Yes.
What challenges have you seen that smallholder farmers are grappling with from the effects of climate change in the different regions that you've been operating?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge, of course, there is the loss that comes from things like floods and crop failure, but that they can deal with. But the unpredictability has been the biggest challenge, because if you're able to predict and know the floods are coming, or you know there is going to be a prolonged drought, then you're able to minimize loss or to even mitigate. But that uncertainty, even when the weather is good and you get a bumper harvest, things still rot on you because you don't have access to the market. So those uncertainties that are visited on them because of the unpredictability of the weather by a Ugandan farmer has had the biggest impact. Having said that, there's nothing that can be bigger than loss of life. When you have too much rains resulting into floods or mudslides or landslides leading to loss of life, even one loss of life cannot equate to property and what have you. But on a day-to-day basis or in year-on-year after basis, really the biggest challenge is that inability to, that uncertainty, that living that life, inability to predict. Because then you can withhold your seed, you can plant it in season, or you can, you know. Yeah.
What do you think is the most effective way to support the smallholder farmer thinking through that uncertainty that you're speaking about?
Information is key. These smallholder farmers are so removed from so many things. They're so removed from even digital platforms. It's only recently that these networks are in all these areas. So the information that we have, you get very quickly on WhatsApp or by Googling or SMS media, they don't quite have access like that. So there are so many things that need to be done to allow them to be included, that level of inclusivity. So information is key, but information and being included in many things. So if they have information about weather forecasts and so on and so forth, but also information about markets, so that they make the right investments, targeting the right markets, and also knowing how to get there. So information is really key, but also information on how to manage the land, because you want to invest in those land management practices when you know what you're going to do with it. And in some areas where they've cracked it, it's really interesting. So one time I went to visit, and I found a farmer who had planted trees. The management objective was timber. When you grow trees for timber, you say start out with maybe 400 trees, then you remove some, because you have a big you plant many trees at the beginning, knowing that some will die. But then some don't die. Sometimes they don't die. So if they don't die, if your objective is to grow for timber, you have to remove some so that the others have space to grow big. So this farmer had not done any removals. He was not even pruning, you know, you prune so they grow tall and what have you. I was like, but now look at your plan. You said you're going to be pruning, you're going to be removing, but you're not. He said, what is wrong with you? Many years ago you came here looking for people who would have forests on their land. Now I have a forest on my land. You are complaining. I said, but you see, your management objective was timber. I said, I changed management objective because I studied that every 2 weeks we have a market here. That market comes with a medicine van. I asked the ingredients of that medicine, and they happen to be the leaves
of the trees I'm growing.
Yes. So I calculated, and every week I get more money than I'll ever get from timber. So but that information given to him, he found a market. So he managed his land in this way, because he had access to a market. So they have so much. They have a lot. They have agency within them. They have the right minds. They are able to make the right decisions, but they need information. They need information on the markets. They need information on the weather. They need information. Okay, they do need information on the practices, but the practices are a lot. These are farmers that we're talking about. They're experts. And also we sometimes took a group of experts, international NGOs, to go and visit one of the farmer groups that is managing a forest through what they call assisted natural regeneration. Now, this is a system where instead of planting trees, you look at the seedlings that are coming up and you just protect them, or you protect logs that have fallen and they sprout out, you know. So you assist the land to grow itself as opposed to planting. So these people are asking, okay, so what technique do you use to see a log that is going to be a stump that is going to be viable? And this man looked at him and said, some of these things we use common sense. So for us, we need reference. So there's a lot of investment that is normally put on the practices, but the practices, the farmer is the expert. on those practices.
They're not a phone farmer. They're on their land.
Yes.
Day in, day out.
Day in, day out. They observe. They know what works, what does not work. But of these things that are working and are not working, what is going, the game changer is the ability for these to generate things that I'll take to the market to bring me income to support the livelihoods on my land. So there's a lot of market-based, market-related, but many of these other things that make that easy, digital inclusion, financial inclusion, all these things of the circles and the VSAs, you know, things, institutions, the capacity, the social capital, the capacity for them to come and sit together. And because without that social capital, you will not achieve scale.
Is EcoTrust doing anything in this regard? What exactly are you doing?
So, like I said, when we go into a community, we are in it for the long haul. And when we go into that community, we build a business ecosystem around tree planting. So it's not just about tree planting, but we build a business ecosystem around tree planting. We identify the value chains, those that provide inputs to the trees, and those that buy the products from the trees. So like I said, including systems like the money systems, the circles and savings and what have you, extension services, the access to markets, and whatever have you. But most importantly, we empower the communities to self-manage. They do the visioning exercise that I talked about, and they are able to even look for the markets and do all these things on their own once we have a vision. So we do these things, but we go as a community at a time. A community at a time, and we do that. Right now, we are working with about 60,000 farmers.
Wow, countrywide.
Yes, our plan is to cover the whole country. But right now, we are in what they call the Albertine Rift and Mount Elgon. We've just started going to northern Uganda. The Albertine Rift is, if you know, Lake Albert and the Rift Valley. So the Ugandan arm of the Rift Valley is called the Albertine Rift.
Where are you in northern Uganda?
Acholi sub-region.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you were speaking earlier about floods and landslides and so on, and I'm bringing your psychology hat back on. Mm-hmm. Those effects, what kind of support is there? Psychological support, mental, you know, health support for farmers that are affected in this way?
Mm-hmm.
I was at an event in Gulu, I think. No, it was in Lira, and a gentleman came with his books on mental health to say we focus heavily on climate change in every other way and forget that it mentally affects people, and that there should be some kind of support there. What would that look like?
Yeah. So and he's really right. Because, like I said, if your way of life is being a smallholder farmer, and then your way of life is full of uncertainties, it puts you in a situation of distress that makes you vulnerable to all those things. Unfortunately, like he has highlighted, there isn't much focus or even much understanding of mental health in Uganda. And even us as biologists or conservationists, it's plants, people, food. We have not yet matured to that level. But having said that, when we are having this vision road journey, we normally do not limit the farmers within the confines of what we are able to deliver. So we have another strategy where we raise the visibility of the communities that we are working with to other actors. So normally it would come up. It would come up either as a challenge when we are doing the Vision Road journey, but in our Vision Road journey, there is always a lane that is focusing on social capital and things of health and whatever have you come up. So health in general normally come up. Yeah. So
who do you flag this to in thinking through the other actors that you work with in this space?
We normally, in the communities, we normally work with the community development office of the district, and then through the community development office of the district, they would guide us to the right offices. But I must say, and then also there are other organizations like Red Cross, but normally those ones are active during
disaster
when disaster is active. That service is so needed, and we don't have enough actors for that service. Including even other things like reproductive health,
yeah.
But mental health and reproductive health are services that are so needed. They're so related to what we are dealing with, but we don't have sufficient effort towards that.
How have you seen climate change affecting, animal behavior, insect behavior,
yeah,
for your case?
Behavior.
And, you know, the distribution of these species and what are the implications on the biodiversity
and the
conservation efforts?
Quite a bit. Both plants and animals. For example, there are predictions on how the land that is viable for coffee growing will change or reduce, because many of these crops are dependent on weather. You know, like when you look at the map of Uganda, there are things called agroecological zones. So the agriculture, it's not by accident that certain areas grow coffee and banana. It's not by accident that certain areas grow sorghum and millet. It's because the climatic conditions and the soils and what have you favor those things. So when there are disruptions or changes, certain areas will become less viable for those plants. And some plants actually will cope better, as in they'll have a wider place to grow, but then the people there are not familiar with that as a land use, with that particular crop as a land use. Their skill sets are aligned to another land use. Now for insects, one of the ones that I have noticed, you have seen that there are places like Chigezi that never used to have malaria. And now they have malaria because the climate in Chigezi those days was not conducive for the mosquito. But now the mosquito can thrive there because it has changed. So now the people of Chigezi have to deal with malaria. But also animals migrate, or animals move according to the ecology. When you see in the dry season, you find all the antelopes in a certain area, it's because that area is conducive for them, or in another season they are in another area. So if the weather patterns change, or certain places that the temperatures change, or the levels of rainfall in that area change, animals that would have been favored for that area move to another area. But also you see an escalation in what we call human-wildlife conflict.
Yeah.
Because if there isn't sufficient food...
They're coming where it is.
Yeah, they'll come.
And that's where you are.
They'll come where it is. Mm.
What are the implications?
Of course, human-wildlife conflict is an implication, but also having the disease burden and just like the disruption of the livelihood systems. If people are familiar with dealing with a certain crop, and that crop, they're experiencing crop failure, now they need to learn new skill. There are disruptions. But for my interaction with the animals, it's usually the human wildlife conflict. And you ask the people of that Budongo, Bugoma, Chibale area, they are really suffering from beautiful animals like chimpanzees. But
your banana garden,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, suffering from crop raiding.
What do solutions look like?
For the communities that we worked with in that Budongo systems, that Budongo Bugoma area, they've actually come up with a plan where they are reestablishing corridors, wildlife corridors. So they've earmarked areas, especially where the rivers cross, and they have agreed to set aside forest boundary to create what they call a line of least resistance. So if there is, even if it's drought or whatever it is, but it's a river and there is a riverine forest, in the hope that the chimpanzees will now use that as they migrate in between the large forest blocks. And it's worked in certain in certain areas. Because if there is sufficient food in those corridors, so the same, almost the same interventions that we use to build our own resilience are the same interventions that we use to build the resilience of the landscapes, to maintain the functions, because just like we depend on those functions through the food productivity and what have you, also the animals depend on the functions within the ecosystem. So if you are able to build the resilience of the ecosystem or to restore the ecosystem back, then it would be able to provide those same functions. The animals move away because they are looking for water. They move away because they are looking for animals. But if even within a drought, the basic functions in their own ecosystem exist, they should be able to be kept in there. For things like the disease, that's where still information becomes important, epidemiology or even information about how those are shifting, to be able to, in the same way as the communities in the south have been, or in the Lake Victoria Basin have, are familiar with how to deal with a mosquito, those communities also need to be empowered, educated on how to deal with a mosquito. It really treats them bad because they haven't even yet built the
Okay. So maybe Pauline, to just wrap this up, thinking through climate change, thinking through the work that EcoTrust is doing, and if you're thinking that the models that you have are the way to go, what would be our takeaway from this conversation?
Our model is based on understanding that land is a resource. Land is a resource, and it's probably the most valuable resource that a Ugandan household has. In Uganda, we are privileged that people have land rights, even though they don't have land titles, but almost every family has land to till. And within the context of a changing climate, we can still build viable businesses on our land. But we need to understand that land is a resource that needs to be invested in. The land is a resource that needs to be invested in. So all these activities like tree planting, like grassed waterways or whatever it is, the fertilizers that you put in the land, make an informed choice or an informed decision on how you see that land assisting you to thrive through a changing climate. And that's why we have this business model of landscape restoration as a business. Because we recognize that over the years we have depleted, destroyed our land, we can restore it back. But our restoration is actually an investment. So what we are putting in that land back is not, yes, it will have an asset that you pass on to the future, but you also make those investments to help you thrive now. But then the other thing is that we need the scale. It needs to be done at scale. Jocelyn, your neighbor, Martin, everybody else in the whole community, me alone with my 2 acres or 5 acres, I cannot thrive through the changing environment. I need to bring my neighbor on board on this side, so that as a collective, we have chosen to manage our land in a sustainable manner for us, for our survival, for us, for all the enterprises that we have on our land to be able to thrive through a changing climate. And for us as EcoTrust, we will work with you to make a business of it. We will work with you to create multiple income streams, both from selling the goods and the services that you generate out of that land, the environmental services. We have people that pay for the carbon that is stored on your land. We have people that pay for the biodiversity through what they call biocredits. We have people that pay even for the watershed services. We have coffee buyers that have decided the trees need to be in the landscape for the landscapes to have enough water to sustain the coffee. So every bag of coffee they get out of that landscape, they put a markup to reward the farmers that have kept trees in that landscape. So we call it payment for watershed services. So for us as EcoTrust, we will support you to find a way of monetizing the environmental services that are coming out of your land.
Thank you, Pauline. I'm ready to go and plant trees.
Yes.
Now, I'm hoping that your offers come with land as well for
no,
me to plant them.
No. Because we will be depriving another farmer of his land in order to give you land. No.
Pauline Nantongo Kalunda, Executive Director of Ecotrust. And as you heard there, a passionate advocate for the smallholder farmers who make up such a vital part of Uganda's economy. In the coming weeks and months, we'll be exploring how a range of climate change impacts are playing out in Uganda. So if you have something in mind that you'd like us to cover, drop us a line at climatetalkpod@gmail.com. For Climate Talk Uganda, I am Josephine Karunji. Thank you for listening and see you next time.